Corey Quinn is the chief cloud economist at the Duckbill Group, an expert at cost optimization in AWS, and is truly a virtuoso of SNARK. In this conversation, we discuss the intricacies of cloud cost, how those bills get out of control, and Corey imparts some wisdom on how to make sense of it all so you can make those dollars go further. All right, welcome to the podcast, Corey. How you doing?
Not dead yet. Thank you very much for asking. It's great to get to talk with you finally.
How's the weather in the Bay Area? I know a few weeks ago it was a little tumultuous, right?
Where I live has historically been on Twitter. And these days that's sort of diffused out into a bunch of other places. But my instinct is to check the internet traffic report, which has a .com in the end of it, if memory serves, and figure, okay, so what's crashing today? That's the beautiful thing about working in technology. I don't have to go outside. In practice, I find that I do occasionally screw up and have to go deal with people in the real world. But, you know, for better or worse, I don't get rained on as much as I used to when I was working construction.
Right on. Yeah, I mean, if there's one thing, so being in Louisville, Kentucky right now, there's, well, really three things. You have bourbon, you have horse racing, and you have rain. It rains all the time around here. And it gets very cold.
It rains on the horses while they're drinking bourbon, and then you can nail the hat trick.
Good point. Yeah, one thing too, like, I don't know, the other day I woke up, you know, taking my kid to school, I walk outside and I'm like, wow, it's a lot colder than normal. And then I look at my phone and it's 5 degrees outside. I'm like, okay, that's pretty cold. And then, you know, of course I work with a lot of folks out of, like, you know, San Jose Bay Area. And it's like, oh, I had to put on a sweater today. It's freezing outside. You know, I don't normally wear sweaters outside. I'm like, oh, you're so lucky. You don't even know.
I grew up in Maine where it got very cold during the winters. And then I moved to Los Angeles and summer never ended. And you lose the ability to deal with it. And now in San Francisco, you have these microclimates where people act like it's a broad spectrum, but it spans 25 degrees Fahrenheit between the peaks and the valleys. So who knows?
Yeah, yeah. So what does a day in the life of a cloud economist at the Duckbill Group look like? Tell me.
That's the fun part. No two are quite the same. What we do as a company is we fix horrifying AWS bills for our clients, and ideally sometimes by extension for the entire customer base when we yell at AWS loudly and productively enough. But it comes down to a few different things. About half of our engagements now are contract negotiation based, where, oh, you're spending tens of millions of dollars a year or more with AWS. They're here for a contract renewal. What should we commit to spending? And that requires a lot of nuance, a lot of understanding of where the company is, where they're going. And my favorite thing to do is look at the lies that companies tell, mostly to themselves. Well, oh, yeah, we're definitely going to fix all that technical debt. You've been saying that for 10 years and have not done so yet. So unless you have things actively in the works, maybe let's assume it's not going to happen before the next contract period expires. It's figuring out what they care about, getting stakeholders to align, and then figuring out how to do the dance with AWS. That's half of it. The rest is cost optimization, which is understanding what their bill is, where the money is going. Past a certain point of scale, you don't usually see massive mistakes comprising a third of the bill. Because, yeah, okay, when you're spending $80,000, you can do that. And, oh, that's a lot of managed NAT gateway costs. But by the time you're spending $100 million, someone has noticed the $30 million of burning tire fire in the basement that maybe we should do something about that by now. And increasingly, it becomes, as companies get larger and larger and more diffuse across different groups, okay, how do we structure a cost management program that makes sense, that works, doesn't enrage people every time they wind up thinking about it, and doesn't cause people to rage quit when you put them in the role of, oh, you're now the cost czar. Your job is to be the department of no. We have our roots in IT when we work in engineering. We've been the department of no. We don't want to continue doing that.
Right on. Yeah. You know, yeah, I like the whole, you know, if you're lighting, you know, money on fire, someone's going to notice. you know, especially with in the cloud enterprise.
In particular, cost is the same thing as architecture, and people miss that. Oh, you're going to fix the AWS bill. You must have a finance background. It's like, no. Well, yes, but also no, because it's an engineering problem. One of the weird party tricks at sad parties that I'm not invited back to is, oh, show me your AWS bill, and I'll describe your architecture to you. And people say, that's ridiculous. And then I do it. And then they say, that's ridiculous, because it is, but it also works.
Bringing truth to follow the money. I like it.
Exactly. Bills rarely lie.
Yeah. I worked in the enterprise space for like over like 15 years, you know, before jumping over to the vendor side of the force, you know, and looking back, I was explaining this to my wife, like she's interested in the guests that I talked to. And I was like talking like, yeah, there's a finance sort of person coming on. And she was asking like, well, what are you going to talk about? And, you know, I sort of explained it like, you know, well, think about it as, you know, this cost control thing of like going to the gym. You know, there's a few things, let's say three things. Like first is cost. You pay that monthly subscription, you know, for access to the whole facility, you know, and you get to come and go as you please. Yet when I go to the gym, I use maybe 5% of the hardware and machines that they have. And, you know, the second is my time. And these days I'm just really busy, you know, a lot going on, and I'm not going to the gym with a comprehensive plan. You know, many times I might not even remember what I worked out the last time I was there. And third is routine, you know, the culture and the routine that you build for yourself, you know, which has a tendency to bleed into your family and your whole family unit. So finding a way, I guess what I'm trying to say is like finding a way to get my money's worth at the gym is kind of hard sometimes, but not nearly as complicated as getting your money's worth, you know, with the cloud. Why is this a big problem? Because cost seems to be at like the top of the list, like even more than it's like cost and security. They're in the octagon duking it out right now.
They're the same problem from a different point of view. But before you go on that path, I just want to say that's a great idea. Like I'll do a stunt later on the internet about that. If AWS starts a gym, that's a great one, because they're going to not charge you like a monthly membership fee. Oh, no. You can come in and do whatever you want once your payment instrument's on file. But then they charge you like some fraction of a penny per radian arc second of bicep curl that you wind up doing over the course of a month. And they just slap together 2 million metrics like that. And sure enough, you're going to wind up having no idea what your bill is going to be until, oops, you have massive overages. The reason that I would say that you're right, security and cost are very aligned. Part of the reason I've been dabbling in security for as long as I have is that you really, really care about those things right after you failed to sufficiently care about those things. But they're also both reactive problems. Whereas you can spend all your time, energy, and focus on solving those, and it doesn't advance your business one iota. It's you have to do it like buying fire insurance for the building. It's a good thing to do. You really are going to be glad you did that in some eventualities, but it doesn't advance the core cause of your business. So it's always easy to let it slip. It's one of the reactive set of problems instead of proactive. One of the things that I always think has been a bit of a challenge for a number of vendors is being on that side of the fence. Whereas if you can speed time to market, speed feature delivery, well, that can triple or quadruple revenue relatively straightforwardly in some cases. So that's what the board is going to get excited about. That's what companies are going to optimize for.
100%. Yep. One thing I really, so I was like going through the website. I hadn't been on there in a little while other than to, you know, the blog section, and that's about it. But I came across a particular statement on the Duckbill Group website. And I think it was, I think the title of the whole blurb was software won't cut it is what it was. And one thing I learned when I worked, you know, on the enterprise side was there is a perception. It's usually higher up the org chart, you know, or if you're working in the security side of the house, maybe that you can purchase a point solution or some piece of software and it's just going to solve this problem and you can check that box. You know, now there's a lot of complications there because some products are going to go further than others. They're easy to deploy and there's, you know, going to be quicker value. Don't get me wrong. But most of the time, you know, and especially when it comes to wrangling cloud costs, it requires much more than a piece of software. Do you have any challenges, I guess, that are top of mind for large organizations facing that reality, you know, once they hit the sort of we can't buy ourselves out of this one sort of moment?
Well, this is going to make me sound a bit disingenuous, but we're currently building out a software product. And the big where this comes from is it makes perfect sense in hindsight. Whereas you look at most cloud cost optimization software packages, they're all doing effectively the same things. They are all more or less better versions of Cost Explorer along some axis or another, but they're all starting and scratching itches that founders tend to have around them. Whereas we started building this with the mindset of, oh, are you spending at least $1 million a month on AWS? If not, please keep going. There is nothing interesting for you here. And that opens a lot of different possibilities. But by and large, it's the tools are the how we wind up solving a lot of these things. What really comes down to is understanding what the actual need is. A company reaches out because their bill is too high. Okay, great. Why do you care? What is it that's motivating you to actively think about the AWS bill? In practice, is it because is it a boundless growth problem that never goes away? Is it because, oh, we look at all of our vendor spend and that's like the number three on our entire list, the first two being real estate and payroll. Huh, that's all concentrating that in one centralized area. Now we really want to know what's going on. Or is there a question of margin? Is there a question of growth? Is it a question of calculating out and predicting what your spend is going to be in 3 years? The answers vary. But it's a deceptively complex problem that sounds incredibly simple. The bill's too high. Okay, great. Why do you believe that? I'm not saying you're wrong. I don't have the context to say whether you're right or you're wrong. But let's make sure we're all talking about the same things here. And also, who are you in this case? Are you a good citizen engineer who's annoyed that you're spending $50,000 a month on this project and it should be half of that, but you have 40 engineers working on it who embezzle more than that in office supplies every month? Or is there something that's going to be a bit more impactful and strategically important to the business? In some cases, one of those small projects might be about to scale massively, so suddenly it really does matter.
Right. Yeah. Good point. To kind of add, well, actually, sort of pivot a little. I'm trying to think of how I want to word this, but let's just say this. So like last summer, my kitchen faucet was leaking, drip, 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 drip. It was awful. It wouldn't stop. I had to replace it. Common household problems. So like I got to imagining, like I'm always thinking about this stuff, like, man, imagine if every faucet inside and outside of my house was steadily leaking. Eventually, I'd probably notice my water bill is going up slowly, and I didn't realize it. It creeps up on me. Not where I want to be, Corey, not where I want to be at all. So this is kind of like enterprise consumption of cloud sometimes where, there are leaks everywhere across teams, products.
All faucets leak. Yeah. And everywhere. The question is, what level is it worth doing an investigation on this? Some of our larger customers, for example, they're spending a few $100 million a year on AWS. Great. But their largest application workload is a few $1 million a year. They just have thousands of them that are scattered everywhere. At that point, doing independent architectural tweaks to a given workloads rarely makes sense. It becomes much more about central planning. It's about making sure the guardrails are in place that speed development and don't slow people down. Because as soon as you do that, shadow IT is just a corporate credit card away, and now you're back where we all started.
Yeah, you're right. There are leaks everywhere. Leaks can, scale probably better than a Lambda function at this point. But, acknowledging, of course, if you're in the enterprise, you got to acknowledge, okay, this is a problem. And, that's the easy part, because back to that sort of like, oh, you're lighting, money on fire. Of course, that's going to raise some red alarms. Knowing, like, at least when I was in this scenario, like knowing where to start in terms of like a bigger course correction, culturally and like organizationally, that's not so easy. How should organizations begin to think about this? If they've got some workloads running, they don't know if they're optimized, cost is way beyond what they originally expected it to be. Where do you start?
It comes down to figuring out what the scale of the issue is. Is it across the entire organization and you're viewing this from a very lofty executive role where you have so many different divisions that it's impossible to start breaking it down? If so, start with big numbers first. Look at it through the perspective of what is the most effective driver of those spends and where are the big levers. In some cases, that's going to be readily apparent. In other cases, it's going to require a bit of organizational spelunking to figure out where things start and stop. The dangerous part is when you start doing it alphabetically, like, because at that point, the people running the zoo project are never going to hear from you. And the people running Project Aardvark are just going to constantly wind up being harassed until they quit. So there has to be a way of thinking about it from that perspective. People optimize for what they're measured on. In a bunch of organizations historically, your import within a company is measured and is directly tied to the size of the budget you control. So if you walk in and say, oh, I found a way to cut your cloud budget in half, what you're really saying is I found a way to dramatically reduce your political influence in the company. That's not a great situation to be in. There's also a lack of understanding of how money works in corporate environments. Oh, if we save a bunch of money, we can use that for bonuses is often a naive approach. No, it means that, okay, other projects could have been greenlit this cycle and instead of been pushed back, could now be done this time instead of waiting a year or a quarter or whatever your budget planning cycle is. That's something that adds power and gives you a way to move faster than your competition does.
Yeah, very true. You know, one thing enterprises tend to struggle with, you know, or any big companies, you know, this is going to be challenging, you know, is, you know, forecasting and budgeting. Forecasting is so hard, you know, in the data center days, you know, where I came from, you know, like a cave right out of the data center into the beautiful cloud. We just over provisioned the tarnation out of things, you know, just in case,
well, you know, hardware refreshes. Well, it took 8 weeks to get a new server in if you got it wrong. So you've got to build that headroom in. Now, the only time it winds up taking 8 weeks to provision something in cloud is if you're spinning up an EKS cluster, because those things take a year and a day to spin up, but for unknown reasons. But yeah, mostly it works within seconds or minutes.
We should do a test and see if Kubernetes cluster is as fast or faster than a VNet gateway in Azure. I don't know. That'd be an interesting test.
It feels
test.
Like we're snail racing at some point.
Yeah. Yeah. So these hardware refreshes, of course, are like, you know, mostly, you know, CapEx, you know, so that the over-provisioning when it was in a, you know, for bad reasons and, you know, resources were not being used in the way that they could, you know, that the over-provisioning went sort of unnoticed most of the time, you know, which skews your ability to accurately forecast and budget, I think.
And there was a forcing function built into it, though, too, that we've lost. If you buy a SAN, a storage area network, these are giant multi-rack appliances that are generally fabulously expensive for those who might be unaware. But great, at some point, it's going to fill up. And now you have an investment decision to make of, do we buy another shelf for the thing full of drives that'll be a fixed expense, or do we optimize what we've got? There are physical constraints to your data centers. In cloud, it never works that way. S3 has infinite storage because they can add drives faster than we can fill them. I know, I've tried with some very badly written recursive Lambda functions. And there's never a big decision point like that of, do we make an investment? It's just another, however much it is, 2.9 cents, 2.3 cents, depending on volume discounting and whatnot, per gigabyte that can go on infinitely. So there's never a, oh, I should go back and clean up those 4 petabytes of data that a data scientist who hasn't worked here for 4 years made and then no one has touched since. There, it's just no one knows what's there. And the upside, okay, we delete stuff we don't need, we'll save money. The downside of getting that wrong, oh, we deleted something it turns out we need, now we've impacted the business. It's only money is a true statement in those scenarios. So cruft accumulates.
Yeah, 100%. That's a really good point. And that, you know, old, you get in the habit of doing things, you know, even for me, like when I really fully went into the cloud space, old habits are hard to break. I mean, I see this all the time. So my wife, she used to be a teacher. She gives music lessons now. I'm out of our house, actually, sometimes. So I'll see these students come in and they've tried to DIY their musical approach, and their technique and things are just so bad sometimes. So usually it's like months of correcting technique, elbow down, do this, do that. And, you know, it's just so hard to get those things, these habits that you've built, to change them. I mean, this is the same with technology. You get in the habit of doing things and you do things a certain way. You deploy a VM, you maybe give it a few more cores and more memory than you actually need. A lot of those things just sort of, you know, using SSH keys on everything, doing, you know, authentication a certain way, like, you know that, and those are the things that you've always done, and they always work at the data center. So you're gonna carry those suckers right into cloud along with you.
I'm remarkably conservative around a bunch of stuff. I'm an old school, grumpy Unix, Linux sysadmin because there's no young people doing that. We're born old and no one's happy. We're always grumpy. That's the rule. But whenever I dive into that, it's okay. I'm the last kid on my block to adopt new file systems, new databases, et cetera, because mistakes will show in horrifying ways. I want someone else to spend the innovation token to find out that, oh, usually this file system's super fast, except when it's not and removes all your data. There's also a story of, oh, how long have you been doing this? How fanatical are you about backups?
Yeah. Checking that backup and that DR box. Let me tell you, a lot of times DR strategy gets really looked at after you're already in production, of course.
We image all of our instances every day and ship them off site. Great. Awesome. But so much of what you're imaging is just dynamically created web servers with configuration that's built in Terraform or CloudFormation or similar. If that goes away, you can reprovision those super quickly. Why are you imaging 2,000 of those things every day and shipping them somewhere else? Don't do that. Like, here's the Git repo. Back that up. We're done.
Right. 100%. Yeah. And it's funny, like in my, so sort of to pivot a little bit, I guess, in my spare time, I try to build things. Woodworking is fun to me. It's relaxing and it gets me away from the computers and work. And I learned over time, measure twice and cut once and don't rush things. If I do rush things, the final product, it may find its way into our fire pit on a nice cool evening. So, one thing I do
a lot of 3D printing and soldering work lately. If I put that in the fire pit, don't breathe that. And I'm pretty sure the EPA would like a few words.
You might die.
But yeah, it's the same principle of building something with my hand. I mean, lately for a conference talk I have upcoming, I've been building a Kubernetes, which is going to be great. Why don't you build that in the cloud? Why are you building that out of a bunch of Raspberry's Pi scattered around your house? Oh, because if I screw this up, I'd rather just have, some magic smoke coming out the back and then they don't work anymore rather than a surprise AWS bill for $5,000 on my personal account.
How many Raspberries could you buy with $5,000? Who knows?
Depends. We're still seeing some supply constraints and buying them in bulk is always tricky. But that's the trick, even with cloud as well as with electronics. Great. I can go and see what the Raspberry Pi folks charge for a Raspberry Pi. Cool. I want to drop $5,000 on them, which is at least a good at retail price. Going to be what? 50 of them? Cool. Bulk pricing definitely enters in. At some point, we're going to spend the absolute high watermark here and wind up just paying retail across the board. That's what fools do. Don't do that.
There you go. Yeah, back up.
And with cloud, it works the same way. On some level, the public pricing is aspirational compared to what significant spenders pay for these things, either across the board, flat rate discounts between services or specific service usage in specific ways. It gets complicated and these things layer together. So how do you factor that into your central IT planning and the rest? You also have things like savings plans, which are great because it gives you a discount on what you're using, going from the biggest discount to the smallest. Mathematically, it's what you want. But across your org, that means that folks who are running things that have massive discounting opportunities always get them applied first. And folks who are running things like Windows workloads, which have very small discounts as a result, are always the last things to get hit. So I'm tired of seeing people getting yelled at because, you haven't optimized your stuff. It's always on-demand pricing. No, it's the last thing that's going to be covered. So back out of all the discounting and grade your teams, if you're doing it that way, based upon on-demand spend, not post-discount. But there's no native functionality to do most of that. You've got to build stuff yourself. Every company does this. And they're doing the same thing and thinking they're the only ones.
Awesome. So I'm going to totally pivot where I was going with this whole thing. Thanks to that response. Let me gather my thought. Okay. So the value and benefits of purely OpEx model sounds really good. Most big companies out there though, they'll pay more for predictability. I'll say maybe. So AWS, for instance, has a discount program, the enterprise discount program or EDP, this brings like a long-term commit option to the table. Can you explain briefly what an EDP is, and is it
sometimes called a private pricing addenda as well? Yeah, they're the way it works by default. If you swipe out a credit card and go spin up an AWS account, don't try this at home, kids. That's how you wind up losing the house. You can start spinning things up. There are some fairly generous free tiers for some things, and there's some surprises and sharp edges lurking around. But you can do whatever you want, and you can theoretically keep going to massive, massive scale. But starting at around $1 million a year in spend, they start offering discounts where, if you agree to either have this level of spend or escalating levels of spend for the next period of time measured in years, we'll give you this percentage discount. And the percentages are tied inherently to size of spend. There are also service-specific discounts that layer in, like, wow, you're using an awful lot of S3, for example, as a part of what you're doing. Huh, you're a data science company. Can't imagine seeing that one coming. Great. So, okay, most of your spend is S3. You can get a S3-specific discount vehicle in place for that. And whether you qualify for these or not is subject to a whole bunch of things that change with the tides. But effectively, in return for committed usage longer term, you get discounts. Think of it as a corporate version that's a more broadly applied version of reserved instances or savings plans. Now, the downside that's always irked me is the beautiful part of the cloud is it elastically provisions only what you need, and then you can turn it off when you're done. Now, please predict your usage for the next 3 to 5 years. What's the point of all this?
That's exactly where I was going. So the main benefits of these EDPs is being, you know, as it's presented as such, is savings long term. You're going in big with this provider, yada, yada, yada. Managing and optimizing these costs, like in the context of this agreement that you've signed, like everybody knows that's dealt with this, it's very complex. And it helps to have some good expertise involved. Preferably someone that has done this before. Is this something that you all help your clients with, is negotiating?
Exactly. In fact, one of our best sources of leads for these types of projects have come from people reaching out like, that's okay, I'm going to do it myself, followed right after the deal is signed by, okay, I'm already booking you for next time because ouch. And there's something to be said for having done this a bunch of times and knowing what is going on. Most people only negotiate these a few times a decade. AWS does them constantly, but we do them constantly too. We're pretty quick to see new incentive programs coming out, shifts in the winds, and we're used to the ebb and the flow of these things. Okay, here's how you wind up presenting what you want, because very few people often go into this knowing what is possible and or what they want. And okay, here's how we structure this to get you to a better outcome. And what does success look like? What does failure look like? Because people aren't dictating what they're doing in an engineering sense based upon their contractual commitments. It's a trailing function trying to describe reality. Your bill is going to be what your bill is going to be. How do you predict it? What are the assumptions that go into that? And taking the naive approach, we're just going to predict you're going to grow 20% year over year forever. That would be nice, but it's not the reality for a lot of us.
So is there like a concrete way or just some sort of approach for organizations to sort of assess whether that commitment of the EDP aligns with the business and like cloud forecast? I mean, just I asked that from the perspective of actually experience where, you know, I've been involved in this type of, you know, discount program across most of the clouds, you know, back when I worked on the other side of the fence. And one of the things that was challenging is you may have a business that's so big, you have multiple lines of business, you've got lots of production applications, you made some acquisitions, and you know, there's just there's a lot of stuff involved. So typically, what would happen is we'd bring in a partner, like one of the big partners, to come in and do like a discovery process, and they interview like application developers and interview the cloud platform teams, and they do a lot of interviews and they put together a lot of like really long documents. And the thing that always bothered me about that is like they're never actually going in and looking at stuff, really. They're not looking at a lot of data. And this is a data-driven problem at its essence. Any thoughts there?
We do something similar, but we fix all of the broken things that you're used to seeing. One of them, and this is key, we're not partnered with AWS or any other vendor in the space because, oh, we're partners with them and we're going to come in here and help you take them to the cleaners on your negotiation. Seems like there's some crossed wires when it comes to incentives there. We have this ancient old timey business model where how do you make your money? We charge the client a agreed upon price. Fixed fee, and then we do the project, and that's the end of it. We're not making money on the backside through AWS or anything like that. Then we're all former engineers and have done so at scale. So there's a question of, great, let's go in. We talk to folks about what's going on, and then we pick and choose certain application workloads and see what's going on. We have access into the AWS accounts. We can look at what's actually going on and reconcile that from the stories that we hear. We can also see a bunch of strange aberrations. Something a lot of tools get wrong on this, for example, is, oh, your bill is up this month and they'll have it in red or it'll be a frowny face. How the hell do you get the context to say that there's a value judgment you can apply here? Maybe that's because sales are through the roof. That's a happy thing. It's not, if you don't have the context, you just look out of touch. So let's figure out what that driver is. And then we, in turn, can go very deep, even to the point of individual query analysis, looking at code in some cases, depending upon what it is that we see, and take an engineering approach to this while also seeing the bigger picture. There's also, you say, what should the numbers be and how does it look? Even if you have a magic formula for this, okay, you're an executive at one of these companies. Great. Okay, so we've done the work internally and we're pretty sure we're right. Please sign this $280 million contract. That's a heck of a gut check. To be fair, you're going to spend that money anyway, so you may as well do it at a discount. But here's more money than you're ever going to see in your life. Go ahead and click the e-signature button. That's a scary thing to do. People want someone in their corner who has been down this road before and knows what happens. Another part of our best source of customers is people who we worked with the last time, either as individuals who've moved on to other companies or new contract or renewal of a contract, because we've been doing this for a while now. And those are the testimonials you really appreciate, because anyone can say nice words for your website, but that was so great, we want to come back and pay you a second or third time. Okay, well, great. You're putting your money where your mouth is in a very real way.
Yeah, one benefit that I think you all have specifically in this area is you're doing like a few different things around cost like really well. Like you stay in that lane. Like a lot of the bigger partners, they're experts at everything. Oh, you want a security person to look at something? Yeah, we'll bring them in right now. Here's the PO. You know,
I got a DM this morning asking if I could help a company with their IAM policies here. It's like, great. I'm going to introduce you to Chris Ferris over at Prime Harbor. He's who we paid to help us with this because I'm pretty good at this stuff. Don't get me wrong. But yeah, I've created something that I cannot defeat is not the most reassuring thing. Schneer's Law from Bruce Schneer, who always says that, anyone can create a cryptographic algorithm that they themselves cannot break. Cool. Hire an expert to come in because mistakes matter. Data is important. Oops, we leaked your data everywhere is an email I never want to send our customers. So how do we make sure this is done correctly? And right, go to an expert who specializes in this. I dabble, but it's not where I spend all my energy. So yeah, talk to an expert, not me.
So when is you mentioned a software component coming out to sort of complete the whole shebang. When is that coming?
We tried to launch something like this called Duck Tools a few years ago. It was a bunch of internal tools that we have used for someone who knows what they're looking at. And how do I wind up getting valuable insight out of this? And it turned out that we didn't do enough customer research first because the market didn't want it. What they all wanted effectively was Cost Explorer, but less money. Or rather, Cost Explorer, but to charge money, but not as much as some of the big players in the space. And trying to out-innovate AWS on the rails that they're going down seems like it's not a great approach. So we kept building these things internally, and we've evolved them in different ways. A big part of it now, for example, is around contract management, where we could keep an eye on how companies are tracking some of these things, as one example. And there's stuff that we wind up seeing that is incredibly valuable, just from a perspective of, okay, we've seen some of these patterns emerge. Let's flag it. Now, if you put this in a tool that most people can access and just download and click here for a free trial, some of this insight can be dangerous if misapplied. It's let's figure out what the context behind it is. By going after large existing customers with this, we can talk to them. We have the relationships built up, which is why early phase, we're using it in our engagements with our customer bases, but we're not selling it directly to the outside world just yet because we haven't sanded some of those rough edges off, among other reasons.
Gotcha. Makes sense.
Yeah, but every demo we give is, when can I get this? Which is generally an encouraging sign.
There you go. Yeah. Yeah, I reinvent this year. Or last year, or in 2024, but the amount of FinOps tools was amazing. There are lots of FinOps tools out there now. They're popping up everywhere.
And the problem I have with them across the board, to be direct, I'm not trying to call anyone out, but they all wind up having 5 or 6 different key points of functionality, and that's it. And invariably, it's the wrong approach to it. I'm not building stuff to check the boxes in the same way. I'm not interested in building, oh, yeah, it's just like it's a modern version of Cloudability before Apptio bought them. No, that's not what we're doing here. There are enough tools out there that do all of these same things. And the ones from AWS, like Compute Optimizer, where it does effectively right-sizing recommendations, has gotten disturbingly good. I'm not going to beat that in any realistic way, certainly not in a way that is worth an investment over the free thing that they're providing for you. So why try? I'd rather point people to the best of breed tool for those things and then focus on the differentiation aspects.
Yeah, that makes sense. Speaking of FinOps, the FinOps Foundation, you know, it's and actually something I like about you're really involved in the community. You're out there, you're talking to people, you're bringing a lot of stuff back in, and you know, you're building your knowledge base by what's out there. What are the folks doing? Where are they at and stuff? And one thing, you know, the FinOps Foundation, which has that handy FinOps framework that I look at every now and then, is now part of the Linux Foundation. I think that actually happened back in 2019 or something. I can't remember, but great guidance, great community, a lot of good transparency. Are foundations like this the right move going forward? Is sort of like a transparent and open education and information sharing, you know, where that stuff is concerned. What are your thoughts there?
I'm unconvinced. I can definitely see the value of it, if for no other reason than getting a bunch of customers in similar situations in the same room to talk to one another. That is something we introduce our clients to each other with double opt-in permission on both sides, to be clear, fairly frequently, because people want to know, who's doing this right in this particular way? We're struggling here, and we'd love to talk to a few other folks who've gone down this path. That's valuable. Foundations are always helpful from that perspective. But there's always the question, too, of what are the incentives? It's changed a few times since then, but when it first came out, I looked into the FinOps Foundation, and I was effectively locked out of a lot of those conversations because I'm perceived as a vendor. Some of my team was in the same boat. So they're looking at this through a lens of, what is it you're... Okay, the only people you want there are not allowed to work for vendors. So it's just, you want just a room full of customers for like special vendors to prey upon? Like, how does this work? And it's changed a lot since then, but I haven't gone back and gone to any significant depth. Some of the stuff coming out of there is great. There are some terrific people involved with it. I've known JR for many years, who's the president of the foundation, JR Stormont. I'm a big fan of his, both personally and professionally. I think that they're doing some spectacular things. I just haven't had the bandwidth to go down that path yet, because quite honestly, a customer has never asked a variety of questions. Among them are you part of the FinOps Foundation? Or do you have an AWS certification? Or what is your partner status with AWS? No one asks those things because they're not differentiated and it doesn't matter in the same way.
Totally agree. I think the one area where these foundations are very, like the CNCF and whatnot, like when you see things happen, like these licensing changes, I've talked about this a ton with open source products. You know, sort of some of these are important. Like you have startups that are built on some of these foundational tools that are, there's tons of them. And if you just rip out the rug from underneath them out of nowhere, and I understand where some of the companies that have had to do this, I understand why they did it. I understand the context. And if I was in their shoes, I mean, I can't say that I wouldn't do the same, but just having a different way going.
People feel betrayed with sudden license changes and the rest, because you've got to put food on the table when you're doing these things. And handing off stewardship of things to a foundation is a great way of solving that. I don't get the sense that that's what the FinOps Foundation is doing. There's no amazing open source tool in this space that, okay, but it was founded by one company, so we want to make sure that it's curated in a vendor agnostic way. That would be a great use case, except all the tooling that's open source in this space that I've ever seen has been basically little more than shell scripts on GitHub by and large. It's okay, this is something someone built to scratch a particular itch. The vast majority of things out there have no conception of scale. Well, it worked on the 10 instances in my account. Great. With 10,000, it starts exhausting rate limits. It doesn't build a queue. You wind up with problems across the board. Session timeouts become real, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And scale is its own form of engineering. And building all that for your 10 instances is ludicrous. But for your 10,000, you better have built something like that out long before then.
Yeah.
And absolutely. People don't put them out publicly. Everyone's ashamed of the stuff, I think. It's also not perceived as strategically valuable. So why put it out? Like, oh, we're going to fix our AWS bill. People are mostly embarrassed by their AWS bill. Unfairly so. But everyone thinks, oh, we're doing a terrible job. We don't want to talk about it. We don't want to wind up sharing with other people. In some cases, companies refuse to tell their own teams what their discount looks like or how much they're spending on the bill, which is weird. Because you can spin up a $50,000 a day cluster, but you're not allowed to know that that's what it costs us is a problem. I don't care if you're normalizing it into just on-demand pricing. You should be aware on some level of the financial impact, at least directionally, of the thing you did, because it might have been a mistake.
Yeah.
Conversely, if you think, well, I don't know, managed NAT gateways are super expensive at $35 an hour. Like, yeah, that's I care about that for the free user who's independently learning in their dorm room, because that's an unpleasant surprise. But at corporate scale, that's not horrible. I care more about the fact of, oh, wow, you have $200,000 a month in that now. How many of them do you really need? As well as the, oh, you're shoving how much data through it. That's really expensive, too, as additional pricing on top of that. Where is that data going? And is there a better way to get it there? The answer is very often yes.
Yeah, it's funny. I was talking to someone the other day about, you know, VPC Lattice hit the market, and I've been testing that pretty extensively. And one thing I realized, I always thought it was a service mesh before I tested it. And you know what? VPC Lattice is not a service mesh. When was the last time you threw an EC2 instance into a service mesh, into Istio? Yeah, you just don't do that.
Lattice does have some fascinating cost savings potential depending upon how you use it, because it removes some data transfer charges while it's doing what it's doing. It's not just a net add on top of them. And it adds some very interesting capabilities of being able to talk directly to things and abstract away the network. The counterpoint is they do a fairly poor job of explaining it, for one. And for another, to discover this, I had to run some experiments myself to prove it out, because they didn't bother to put it in the documentation. AWS releases so much stuff and then doesn't talk about it effectively. And so many times people don't realize things exist.
Likewise. Yeah. I use those AWS community builder credits for all my secret lab experiments, you know, so I never eat the cost. Anyhow. Yeah. This has been a great conversation. I think we're coming up on time, and I just want to, anything you want to tell the audience, any imparting advice you'd give on wrangling in their cloud costs?
Start with the big numbers first. Remember that small things cost less than big things. Some things have weird pricing dimensions. Look at the big items on your bill first. And if you have any questions, please don't hesitate to reach out for me. You can find me at lastweekinaws.com for my adventuring approach, and duckbillgroup.com for the consulting side of it. If I can fix your problem with a half-hour phone call, why wouldn't I? I'm not going to sit there like, oh, you got to pay me first. I know the answer, but until you give me money, I'm not going to tell you anything. I hate those models, and I refuse to participate in them. When it gets to a point of, okay, now I have to do some serious digging and go into these things, great. That's called a consulting engagement, and it's awesome. I'm thrilled to go down that path. But if it's one of those things I've seen 15 times so far this year already, just ask me. I'm thrilled to wind up pointing in the right direction. If I can't help you, I won't try to sell you something.
Awesome. Yeah, best ending segment I've ever heard. You know, you give away your time in small quantities for the betterment of the community and, you know, figuring out some problems. That's awesome.
The only reason I have a business is because people did me favors when there was no reason for them to do it. And honestly, all you can do is pay that forward.
Yeah, it makes the world better. It makes technology better, really. Yeah. All right. Well, thank you very much, sir. Appreciate the time.
Thank you for tolerating me. It's always a pleasure to talk with you.